Sorry. This is an interview with David Reuter for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. My name is William Thomas. The date is May 27th, 2015, and we're at the Northwestern Law School in Chicago. So thanks very much for agreeing to speak with us. We usually start with a little bit of background, so I understand that you're from Wausau, Wisconsin originally?
That's correct.
Okay. So then, and then you did your undergrad at Williams College.
Williams College.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about kind of what your aspirations were originally going to Williams, and what did you major in there?
Well, my aspirations in going to Williams were pretty low. I lived in a community of about 25,000 people, and my father had spent a year at law school at Harvard before he enlisted in the U.S. Army in the First World War, and when at one point I was active in the High Y in Wausau, Wisconsin, and a young man came to speak to us, and he had a brochure published by the Chicago Tribune showing all of the school, or not all, but many schools in the country based upon various statistics. And he was from Carleton College in Minnesota, and his Carleton College was number two in most of the rankings, but Williams College was number one. So I said to my parents, where's Williams College? And they said, oh, we have a friend who went there. And they knew about it. And my dad was, I think, interested in exposing me to other areas of the country. So I sort of selected it because I thought it was the best place to go and I could go away from Wisconsin.
Okay, what did you study there?
I studied political economics. I was the first major in political economics. I started in economics, but it turned out that even at that time at Williams, you had to have a very strong math background to be in an honors program in economics. So I switched to political economy, which was a combination of political science and economics.
Okay. And then I guess after that, you were in the Army. This was during the Korean War. You finished in 1951?
Yes.
Okay.
I was editor of the newspaper at Williams College and got to know the president of the university. And at my graduation or near my graduation, the draft was still on, and I wanted to go to law school, but my draft board in northern Wisconsin said no deferments for law school, you'll have to go to service now. So one of my friends told me he was going to work for the CIA, and I said, what's that? This is very early in the CIA. So several of us went down to Washington, and I received a recommendation from Finney Baxter, with his name, who was an original member of the OSS in Europe and was a friend of the person who was then running CIA. So I was admitted into something called the Joint Officers Training Program. But in order to, and the idea was that I might become a full-time service person for the rest of my life, and I had to admit that as something I might do. And so I went down to Washington, but I had to, they said they wanted, if I was going to do that, I had to have go to officer candidate school. So I selected the U.S. Army because my father had been in the Army, and then went through basic training for 14 weeks and then to Fort Benning, Georgia officer candidate school for 22 weeks. And then I went off to Kansas and attended a intelligence school and went back to Washington and was then on a desk job for the CIA for 18 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that happened to me was that I had a look at my file when I was at the CIA office, and I was paging through it, and it said, do not recommend for covert activities. Too honest. So anyway, after service, I applied to Harvard Law and to University of Wisconsin Law. I was accepted for both and decided to go to the University of Wisconsin Law School.
Okay, so yeah, was that just a decision to go back home? Or?
It was. I had spent 4 years at Williams and 3 years basically in Washington, D.C. and the East, and I thought it was time to go back. And I thought I was going to go to Wisconsin Law School and practice law in my hometown.
Okay. So you finished that in, was it 1957?
Right.
Okay. And you joined a firm for a few years before you ended up here at Northwestern?
Yes. It was a firm called Quarles, Harriet, Teschner, and Nelke in Milwaukee. It was a very large firm at that time in Milwaukee. It was 18 people.
What sort of work were you doing there?
I did basically corporate and securities work. I learned about the securities laws at that firm. I'd never had any courses in it at Wisconsin, but I participated in an underwriting. Then at the end of my time there, I was involved in a preparation of a brief in a case called Kohler versus Kohler Corp. It was a dispute between the then governor of Wisconsin and his family corporation. And it involved Rule 10b-5 of the Securities and Exchange Act, Securities and Exchange Commission. When I came down to Chicago to go to law school here, to go become a member of the faculty here, I became interested in the background of Rule 10b-5 and wrote my first article in that area.
How is it that you made the turn into being a professor of law?
I had been ambivalent about my career when I graduated from law school. I didn't know whether I wanted to be a lawyer or a law professor or even a law administrator. I don't think I was seriously interested in law teaching at that time. But when I graduated, the dean of the law school stopped me on the street and he said, "If you should ever want to go into law teaching, let me know." I was first in my class at the University of Wisconsin, so he thought I might have some interest in teaching. And later on, I became interested in teaching, and I called him. He was then the dean at Northwestern. Mm-hmm. He said, "Well, if you want to go into law school, come here."
So you thought straight away then that your specialty would be securities law?
No, no. I did not. No, I came down here and taught corporate law.
Okay.
And wrote that first article on Rule 10b-5. It was turned out to be a very controversial article because Rule 10b-5 is a rule adopted by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it was enforceable by the Securities and Exchange Commission in court and in administrative proceedings. But there was no express provision in the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934 giving a private person the right to enforce it. So a doctrine had arisen in the federal circuit courts and district courts that there would be an implied private right of action by individual plaintiffs to enforce the SEC rule.
Litigation against fraud, essentially?
Yes. Okay. The Rule 10b-5 is the main, turns out to be the main anti-fraud rule adopted by the SEC. So when I began to do the research about the background of Rule 10b-5, I became interested in the legislative history of the Securities and Exchange Act, and I looked at the legislative history, and I found that there were express private rights of action in the 1934 Act, but this Rule 10b-5 was being enforced without an express private right of action. It was an implied private right of action. And I became interested in what the legislative history was and read the hearings and all of the of the reports, and I read the statutes very carefully, and I came to the conclusion that not only was there no legislative history supporting the implied right of action, but that the legislative history pointed in the other direction. So I wrote this article and said, despite the fact that all but one federal circuit court has upheld the private right of action, that's wrong.
The implication was that it would be solely the SEC's right to enforce against fraud?
That's right.
Okay.
And that was upsetting to the Securities and Exchange Commission, because it was then litigating a case eventually called J.I. Case Co. v. Borak, in which they were seeking, they were in an amicus brief position, but they were supporting the proposition that there was an implied private right of action to enforce the federal proxy rules, not Rule 10b-5, but another rule. My article suggested that there should be no private right of action under Rule 10b-5, and probably under that rule as well. So they wrote a reply. They wrote a reply article to which I replied. Mm-hmm. Then I received a reply to my reply, and I wrote another article in reply to that article, and that in some way that made my reputation.
Mm-hmm. Were these issues ever resolved through additional legislation?
When the Supreme Court decided the Borak case and decided there was a private right of action.
Okay.
And later on, when it went to looked at the first few cases involving Rule 10b-5, it did very little analysis and simply said, well, of course there should be a private right of action because it is it's a necessary supplement to commission action.
Mm-hmm. So is it this whole set of correspondence or discourse that eventually got you centered in the area of securities law, or did you continue to be more broadly ranging across?
Well, I was still at that time. Securities law was not such an important topic as it is in law schools today. And so one taught corporations, and then you taught a little bit on securities law as you did that. And this was during the 1960s, and during that period, a casebook emerged called Jennings and Marsh Securities Regulation in California. It was the first casebook devoted entirely to securities regulation. I began then to teach a seminar in what I call corporation finance, but gradually I began to concentrate more and more on securities matters, and finally I invented a course called Securities Regulation here using the Jennings and Marsh casebook.
Tell me a little bit about the broader academic community who's interested in this. Of course, the figure Louis Loss comes up ubiquitously, but I'm wondering what the broader terrain looked like in the 1960s and 70s. We don't get too much into the academic community in a lot of these interviews. I'm very curious about it.
Well, the academic community was very slight at that time. Louis Loss was still at the SEC, had not gone to Harvard to teach, and Dick Jennings and Harold Marsh were in California. Dick Jennings was teaching at Bolt Hall, and Harold Marsh was a practitioner, but I think was teaching as an adjunct at UCLA. But I was one of the very first securities law professors in the country, basically. And interestingly, I think it was that persona that led me basically to my future in the SEC.
Okay. Should we deal, how much depth do we want to go into on the subject of the things that you looked at in your teaching as a professor? It's something that I frankly don't know.
I don't think it's too relevant to the SEC, except that I did I did teach, well, I'm one of the few, I hate to admit how old I am, but I'm one of the few law teachers who can recollect the history of the anti-fraud rules as they happened.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cases that I taught, famous cases that I taught, was the Texas Gulf Sulphur case, in which the SEC had sued Texas Gulf Sulphur for violating the disclosure laws and Rule 10b-5.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught that case and wrote about it, and actually had some interesting thoughts, which I wrote in my things. And ultimately, I also became involved in the American Bar Association, which was a very important ingredient in my progression through the business law field. The American Bar had something called the Section on Corporations, Business and Banking Law, and Corporations, Banking and Business Law, and it was the people running the section were the very best lawyers in the country, and so I got to know a lot of them in that environment, in the corporate area, not mm-hmm. so much in the securities area.
Being located here in Chicago, was there any opportunity or a particular concentration, if not from you, and then people in the area on commodities and futures and that sort of thing that's centered here?
Well, as you know, the commodities mm-hmm. Industry started here with the physical commodities and mm-hmm. eventually expanded to include the financial instruments. But during the 60s and 70s, it was mostly physicals, and it wasn't until, I believe it was 1974, that the Commodity Futures Commission was created.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the interesting point was that when I started here, I joined the Chicago Bar Association Committee on Securities Regulation. And in 1964, I started teaching here in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1964, at one of the meetings, I met a lawyer named Milton Cohen. Milton Cohen had been in the 1930s, had been the director of the Division of Public Utilities. I think that's the name of it mm-hmm. at the SEC. Because they were then disbanding the Public Utility Holding Company Act, or dealing with it, disbanding some of the companies that had been thought to be the problem in the Depression and the stock market run-up. Anyway, Milton was head of that division, and later came back to Chicago to practice law, and then was called back to Washington to become the director of the Special Study of the Securities Markets. And he's given his papers to the Historical Society.
Mm.
Milton was, in a sense, my mentor. Eventually, I learned a lot about the securities laws from him. I used to have lunch with him once every couple of months at his invitation. Eventually, I became of counsel to his firm. And in 1975... I spent a full year with the firm, and it was just at the time that the Securities Act amendments of 1975 were being adopted. Those were very important amendments, and I may be telling you more than you know, but they were amendments in which, at recommendations were in the special study. Based upon recommendations in the special study, the SEC was given power to impose disclosure requirements on a group of companies which were not then listed on securities exchanges, but which had $10 million in total assets and 500 shareholders or more. So it had a great expansion of the disclosure laws in the U.S., that is, the disclosure laws requiring annual and periodic reports of companies which were called public. and this was an expansion of the definition of public. Mm-hmm. So Milton had an enormous impact on the securities area. In addition, his practice included representation of the Chicago Board Options Exchange, which was just then being created, mm-hmm. and the then called Midwest Stock Exchange. So during the period that I was in his office working with him, I learned about the markets. And I also was counsel to him in his office the year that the 75 Act amendments were adopted. One of the fascinating parts, as I later looked at my own career, was that Milton represented the Chicago Board Options Exchange and the Midwest Stock Exchange. He had a great reputation. He went down to Washington and testified that it was wrong for the New York Stock Exchange to have a monopoly over the securities markets, and that what was needed was competition rather than monopolization. And if you read the preamble to the 75 Act amendments, you'll see references to this, which he was successful in. So I'm going a little forward in the story here, but when I was nominated for the commission, I had lunch with Milton, and I said, "Well, I'm really happy that I learned so much under your guidance." But I said, "And I followed the SEC very carefully, but I don't really know a lot about the securities markets." I said, "Do the commissioners of the Securities and Exchange Commission, most of whom come without background in the markets, have enough skill to adopt all of the rules that are adopted by the commission?" And Milton said, no, they don't. But the commission has delegated the authority to approve stock exchange rules to the staff of the commission. So they don't have to deal, the commission mm-hmm. does not have to deal with every particular matter. So it was another example of Milton of helping me and advising me.
Okay. Was there a more general kind of perceptible pushback against the expansion of regulatory authority, particularly in the 1970s? I'm thinking of people like Frank Easterbrook, for example.
Well, they were not old enough then.
Right.
This was a period of time in which the business community was fascinated with the way in which the securities laws were being expanded,
mm-hmm.
and particularly the 75 Act amendments. And at about that time, I'd go back one step. The other lawyer in town who was prominent at the SEC was Ray Garrick Jr., who became chairman of the SEC. I knew Ray, and he actually taught here as an adjunct professor, so I got to know him that way. And I'm going to say 1966, Ray and I talked about a suggestion by some lawyers that there should be a project to codify the federal securities, the six statutes administered by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And we held a conference here at Northwestern in our Lincoln Hall and brought in, at that time, all of the great securities lawyers in the country. Ray Garrett was there, Al Sommer was there, Louis Loss was there, David Hinkle was there, Milton Cohen was there, I think Frank Wheat was there, and Irv Pollack, maybe some of the old names were there, and they decided that it would be very useful to have a project to codify all these statutes. So they went to the American Law Institute, which agreed to start a project which they called the Federal Securities Code Project.
Okay.
I was just showing him the book. And the Federal Securities Code Project had the way the ALI is set up. The ALI has a reporter for a project like this, and Louis Loss was the reporter.
Okay.
Then there are a group of people who are called the consultants, and they're a smaller group of people. Then there's a group of people called the advisors, who also provide input, and then it goes to the membership for approval. And that project started, and Milton finally suggested to Louis that I be made a consultant for purposes of the civil liability provisions of that project. And the project lasted for almost 10 years. Meetings, I think, every 6 months, and long drafting. And at the end of the 6 months, at the end of the project, the code was enacted. But it had, during its enactment process, because Louis Loss had been at the SEC and was very close to it, he consulted with the Securities and Exchange Commission about what might be done. Two events took place that were fascinating to me in that instance. One was that Milton Cohen wrote an article called "Truth in Securities Revisited" in 64, 65, something like that. And he said, what is clearly deficient in our securities laws is that the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 should have been passed before the Securities Act of 1933. The Securities Act of 1933 states that when a company raises money with the public, it must disclose everything about its business and everything about what it's going to use the money for. Then in 1934, the Congress adopted a law which said all listed companies must disclose everything about their business on an annual, quarterly, and event-driven basis. So Milton, in his article, said that's backwards. We should have the companies disclose everything about themselves, and then when they go public, they can say, "Here are the documents about ourselves, and now we'll tell you how to use the money." Mm-hmm. So that became one of the prime aspects of the Federal Securities Code Project, to go to Congress and have Congress rewrite these laws and have the disclosure piece be first, and then say you can then use the disclosure documents as part of your 33 Act registration statement. Louis was so close to the SEC that he went to the SEC and said, this is a great thing we're working on. And the SEC said, that's terrific. And so they accomplished by rule what the drafters of the Federal Securities Code would have had been done by legislation. And it took a lot of the force out of that whole project. The other thing that happened was that in 1975, there was by that time a fairly great concern among the business community that the rules of implied private rights of action under Rule 10b-5 were developing so that if a company made a public misstatement which was relied upon by investors, the investors could sue the company, and not only the investors who had been engaged in transactions with the company or with individuals within the company, but all investors. The theory was that the misstatements caused injury to the investors, and they should be able to have private recourse. And if you think about it, this the amount of damages, if you eliminate what's called privity of contract, the amount of damages are really potentially substantial. And when I used to teach this, I used to talk about, well, let's assume that your company issues a statement. Your company's worth $100 million. And as a result, there are a million shares traded during the period, and your company's stock goes down by, as it goes up erroneously, by $5 or $50 or whatever it is. You can get enormous damages. I used to say that the problem here is for your company is that when the lawsuit is brought by in a so-called class action environment where all of the potential injured investors are in one lawsuit, the numbers are so large that you're talking about what I used to describe as a bet your company litigation. You lose it and your company's gone. So the law, as the law was developing in that period of time, there was a real question about whether the mental state for the acting party, the disclosing party, had to be intentional or whether it could be negligent. And during the in 1975, a case was decided called Hockfelder, under the name Hockfelder, in which the Supreme Court held that you needed scienter, intent to deceive. And that was a big breakthrough in terms of the potential damages in this litigation context. And it also served to inspire the corporate defendants bar to be concerned about the fact that liabilities were growing too greatly. And so the civil liability portions of this federal securities code, which we were planning to organize all of the express liabilities together and put them in one place, and then to have the Rule 10b-5 aspects codified as well, they became central to the codification project. And at least it's my own observation now in reflection that what happened was that the members of the corporate bar became concerned that if this whole civil liability panorama was taken back to Congress and said, okay, Congress, now you decide whether what the mental state's going to be, you decide what the damages are going to be, you make all these decisions, there was the possibility that Congress would come out on the wrong side. So during the 70s, there began to be some carving back of the potential remedies, and I think the securities bar decided not to, that it would oppose the legislation. So the code project never was adopted by Congress.
Okay,
but for me, it was a wonderful experience because I got to know everybody. In fact, I was just showing you the. I have here the list of the consultants of this project, and there are names of people who are knowledgeable. I'm just going to read some of the names because there are people in your historical. Milton Cohen is a consultant. First, you had Lewis Lost, and the assistant reporter was Victor Brudney from Harvard. Milton Cohen, Vern Countryman, Ray Garrett Jr., who was the former chairman from Chicago, David Henkel from New York, Homer Kripke, a famous NYU professor, Milton Crowell, a wonderful Washington lawyer, Bob Mundheim, who was who is still active and a good friend of mine, and I was then a consultant. And just to give you a few names from the rest of it, is Kenneth Bjalken, the advisor, mm-hmm. William Carey, a former SEC chairman, Arthur Fleischer, who was a very famous lawyer in New York, and one of those who wrote an article opposing one of my articles, Henry Friendly, a very famous judge of the Second Circuit, Richard Dick Jennings from California, Al Sommer, a former commissioner, Frank Wheat, another former commissioner, and so you had this very, very well-known group of people involved in the project, and I got to know all of them.
That was very fascinating. It was just a couple months ago that I was interviewing Ed Fleischman, actually, yeah. And so he was. It kind of gave me sort of a similar view of this, but of course from the side of the corporate bar. So
it's, was he? Did he indicate that the project had failed because of the corporate bar's concern?
I'd have to go back and review what he said, and I understand that he's annotated things in the meantime as well. But I'm not sure if he got into.
You see, Art Fleischer yeah. and Bob Mannheim were also very active in the special study of the securities markets with Milton Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this same history. They're about my age, basically.
No, it's educational for me because most people I've been speaking to have been kind of 1980 and forward. And so this older history is something that I've not personally had the opportunity to get into.
This may be a little, this will be a little forward from chronological mm-hmm. development, but I think it's apropos of this. In the early 1970s, Al Sommer, the former commissioner, and Jim Hewitt, a tax professor in California, and I'm just losing his name, and a third lawyer, a name will come to me before we get finished, decided there was they should have a program in California about the securities laws, which would be similar to what the Practicing Law Institute has in California. And I'm looking for a brochure that will give me. I'm just embarrassed. Okay. I'm embarrassed not to have his name right on the tip of my tongue. But when you get older, anyway, I'll get
all
it
right.
later. But anyway,
that happens.
It's one of those things that we could see. Break the tape. You can't remember the name, but it'll come to me later on. Any event, they started this institute in California, and they started it in the winter in January, and enticed all the good securities people from the SEC and the securities bar in New York and Washington to come to California for a 3-day meeting, and it got to be sort of a house party for all the SEC people, in which the faculty came out and brought their wives and spent a really wonderful time. And Bob Mannheim and Art Fleischer and others were very active in that together. And I got another area in which I got to know a lot of people because I was a young talkie professor then.
And how much did all these, at the time, current events make their way into the teaching? Was it
point of view, the law was developing so fast, and I was intensely involved with it, both from a research and writing point of view, and from this federal securities code point of view, and knowing everybody, mm-hmm. that I was able to kind of live it as I went through, one of the things that I think is very wonderful about my career is that I've gotten to know all of the commissioners at the SEC from probably the days of Al Sumner and Ray Garrett forward to now, mm-hmm. partly through these other activities. And also many of the directors of the SEC staff, because they all came out to the conferences in California.
Okay.
So now we're back at my teaching and where I was.
Right. So then you became dean from 1977 to 85. Did that inhibit you at all from being able to take part in this whole community, or was it
well,
something you were able to keep up with in that period?
Obviously yeah. it did. We become dean, you're an administrator.
Right.
What I did, though, however, I continued to teach in the field. I didn't stop my teaching. I didn't do any research during that field time. At least I may have written one thing or another, but not much. The Alan Levinson, that's the third lawyer.
Oh, okay.
That's the name I was thinking. I'm so sorry, Alan, I forgot you. But I kept teaching, and I stayed current. It's hard for a dean to keep teaching, but I did it, and I just kept going. And indeed, I'm doing some writing now, and I was reviewing this Federal Securities Code project, and I found one incident on the floor of the ALI meeting in which the Louis Loss was suggesting that there should be liability imposed upon a director of a corporation who had signed the disclosure documents that went out in the public. This idea was that if the liability was imposed on that director, that would cause the director to use more diligence. And I was just reading the transcript of it, and I got up on the floor and said I regretted that, since I was a consultant to the project, I had to disagree with the reporter. I think it's wrong for us to impose liability, personal liability, on the directors for this. And that caused an enormous floor debate. And the reason this came to mind was because they kept referring to me as Dean Reuter mm-hmm. in the debates, and some of these same names I've just talked to you about got up and spoke for and against what I was saying. And at the end of the debate, the vote was something like 95. And I made a motion, and it was 95 against my motion and 94 in favor. So the project went forward with what they called brackets around these portions that said we couldn't really decide.
Okay. Well, should we cover anything else before we get to your time at the SEC? Or
no, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, then, how did it come about then that you became chairman of the SEC?
President Reagan had been. After President Reagan was elected, he appointed John Shadd as chairman of the SEC. And John had been in office for something like 6 years and was tired of it. And he did receive the ambassadorship to the Netherlands. His ambassadorship to the Netherlands was to begin in June. My name had been circulated at an earlier time as a possible chairman of the SEC. In fact, I received a call one time when I was dean from Harold Williams, who was the then chairman of the SEC, and he said, "I'm worried I'm a Republican," so I said, "I'm worried that the Republicans are going to nominate somebody who's too conservative for the SEC. Would you be interested in it?" And I said, "No, Harold." I said, "I'm in the middle of a capital campaign here at the law school, and I can't step away. So I said no. But then when it became known that that John Shadd was going to leave, and the administration was having trouble finding a replacement for him, there was lots of speculation about who might be chairman. And I didn't even know my name was being talked about. And I went to a meeting of the American Law Institute, not about the Federal Securities Code project, but about something else. And I was in Washington. It was in May. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and they said, they want you at the White House. And I said, what for? And the person said, for the job. I said, you mean the job? And the answer was yes. And they said, they're trying to find you. And so you'll have a message when you get back to your hotel. So I went back, and I did have a message asking if I could come over to the White House to interview the next day. I went over there, and I was then interviewed by the president's counsel, A.B. Culverhouse, and by the chief of personnel, A.B. Tuttle, Bob Tuttle. And we had lunch. And they said, well, we're considering you as a potential chairman of the SEC. And then they said, would you be interested? And I said, yes. And they asked me all kinds of questions. And at the end of the time, they said, well, now we're going to go up and see Howard Baker. Howard Baker was then the president's chief of staff. So I got to Howard's office, and he told me that they had been looking for a chairman of the SEC, but had not had much success. Said they we had looked at Wall Street people, and we asked John Whitehead, who was Assistant Secretary of State and a former Wall Street person. They said he said no. So we asked. We started to ask regulators.
Was this sort of I know John Shadd had been an executive beforehand, so are they kind of looking to continue in that vein?
They were looking. They were looking at. They said they were looking at Wall Street people, regulators, and then he finally said, well, they asked Rudy Giuliani if he would do it. He said no. So he said that Howard Baker was a wonderful man and a nice sense of humor. He kind of looked at me. He said. Well, he had to look at lawyers. And I said, well, why me? I said, I have no political connections at all. In fact, when I was interviewed at luncheon, after they got through all these questions, they said, we have one last question for you. Remind me, this is the Reagan White House. And I said, what's that question? They said, are you a Republican? I hadn't been active at all. So I said, well, how do you tell? He said, well, in what party did you last register to vote? And I said, Republican. So when I got there, and I said, why am I here? And Howard Baker said, well, we asked, we couldn't seem to get very far with the appointment process using the personnel office. So we've taken the appointment process into the counsel of the president's office. And he said, all of us have asked our friends who might be a good chairman of the SEC. And he said, your name came up on all the lists. Which I thought, I was very pleased by that. But it turned out that Howard Baker was a good friend of Howard Treenan's, who was the chairman of the Board of Trustees at Northwestern and had known me in my capacity as dean, that they had asked former SEC people, including Al Sumner, who was involved at this conference in California, And they had asked a lot of American Bar Association people, and I'd been active in the American Bar Association. He said, so they all were positive about you, so we're putting you on the list. I said, well, so what's next? I said, I'm on the list. He said, well, there are three people, and we won't tell you who the other two are because we don't want the names to get out. He said, if the names are out, he said, there'll be a lot of flurry of inquiries, and we don't really want to have that happen. So I said, fine. I said, well, can I do anything? He said, no, don't do anything, because they said, the more you talk, the more chance you'll have to get have criticism. So don't do anything. So next morning, I was on a train going up to New York, and the New York Times had a story saying, here are the three persons being considered by the White House for the chairmanship of the SEC. And they had the three names. The White House simply didn't want me to be the person to say who they were.
That was very interesting. We spoke to, like I mentioned, we spoke to Ed Fleischman a couple of months ago.
His name was on the list. He was one of the three.
Right. And he was telling us about how the staff were saying, oh, no, anybody but Ed. But more to the point, he was mentioning that, I guess that was in 85, 86, that the administration at that time had been looking to kind of, it was looking out for its ideological legacy. So it was looking for somebody very market-oriented. Of course, John Shadd had that reputation. And
there was actually a piece in the Wall Street Journal that spring when I was in on vacation, naming the three possibilities, and they were all, I would say, free market economists.
Mm-hmm. And even Joe Grunfest said that, you know, he was viewed as being a reliably market-oriented Democrat.
He was the most market-oriented commissioner.
Right. And so do you think it was just them not being able to push that view through? I mean, you're viewed as being more of a moderate Republican, I guess. So
they didn't know much about me.
Right.
They didn't know much about me, except, interestingly enough, I've been writing an article just recently, and I went back and read my old Law Review articles. And I said, whoa, was I conservative in those articles? I was concerned about the undue expansion of Rule 10b-5.
Right.
And if I read those, they would have thought I was very conservative and not pro-regulatory.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one other piece of information that I think I can tell. I will do it anonymously, and if you can find out who the person is, it's all right.
Okay.
I won't do it anonymously. I better not. You can find this out. There was a third person on the list, and I later learned that he had been asked to be chairman, but that he had gone to Wall Street to try to persuade firms in Wall Street to support him. And in the context of their discussions with him, they said, what do you think about takeovers? And he said, I'm against them. And he said that caused a lot of pressure to be put on the White House, and I didn't get the appointment after all.
The takeover issue is kind of an interesting one. Now, one thing that Joe Grunfest said in his interview with us was that there were splits within both parties in pro and against regulatory action to try and prevent hostile takeovers. And you mentioned in your recollections that you wrote about 10 years ago for the Historical Society that you were attacked by Democrats in the confirmation process for your views on the subject. So I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a sense of what the politics of that were at the time.
Well, as I indicated, this was middle 80s. The takeovers were really hot items.
Exactly, yes.
And I was at it was interesting to me, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee was Senator Proxmire, who was from Wisconsin, And I had met him when I was editor-in-chief of the Law Review at Wisconsin as well. And his family owned the printing company where we printed our Law Review. So I met him one day when we were delivering or picking up books. And he never remembered it, but I did. And then I thought, well, this is going to be a cinch. You'll say you're a Wisconsin person, and I'm in favor of you. But he, in the committee, voted against me, and he said, "I believe you're a Republican. You're not going to be a strong enough regulator, and I'm not going to vote for you."
That's kind of a peculiar position because, of course, the chairman is expected to be from the president's party. So I mean, would he have just been against anybody in that?
I never did quite know where he came out. I think, you know, there's a lot of posturing in Washington. The main antagonist I had was a senator from North Carolina, and he had just had a takeover event in his state, in which one of the companies which was the target, Senator Sanford was his name, one of the companies that was his target was forced to disband and sell off pieces of the company, and it was very injurious to the community. So he was dead set against takeovers, and in our private conversations, we know you go around and talk to all the senators before. In our private conversations and in the public hearings, he asked me what my views on takeovers were, and I said, as I remember it, I said, "Senator, we don't know which takeovers are good or bad. We know some of them are good for the economy and some are bad. And all I know is that the Congress has written the law to regulate the takeover situation, and I will enforce it. I have no position for or against takeovers." And as a result, he voted against me in committee, and later put a hold on my appointment. You know, in the system mm-hmm. that exists, one senator can keep the vote from coming to the floor. This got to be the first week in August 1987, and the Congress was going on recess at the end of the week, first week, and he put a hold on the nomination, and it was clear that if my nomination wasn't confirmed in the first week of August, it would be well into September before I became chairman. And by then I knew that the commission was in some disarray because of the divergent views of the commissioners at that time, and they weren't getting anything done. And I was very interested in being there and being able to become somebody to make decisions. So one of the people that I had known in the ABA was a man named William Webster, Bill Webster, who had I had met at one of the ABA meetings, the Coast Salt section meetings, mm-hmm. council section meetings, were also like house parties. You spent 3 days, so I had been with him many 3 day meetings. And one day at breakfast, he said, "Can I breakfast with you?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "You're now down dean of the law school." He said, "And I'm a circuit judge in the circuit here in Missouri," he said, "but I've been asked to be head of the FBI." He said, "What's it like to be an administrator?" So I gave him my advice as best I could, and he was just kind of trying to see what was going on. But eventually, he was one of the people who recommended me when they went around searching for people, mm-hmm. and finally, I called him up. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't Bill Webster. It wasn't Bill. Bill had been one of the people that had been Dale Bumpers was a senator from but Bill was also positive in getting me forward and was very, very.
And he did go to the FBI.
Right? Yeah, he did go to the, and then CIA.
Right.
But anyway, it was Dale Bumpers who was a senator from Arkansas, I think, and he was a law school alumnus, and I'd gotten to know him when I was dean because he came up to give a speech one time. So I really, believe me, didn't know anybody in Washington when I went. Hadn't any support, but it wasn't like I had places to go, and I didn't think calling the White House was going to make any sense because these were Democrats that were against me. So I called Dale, who was a Democrat, and I said, "Dale, I said, the vote was 17-3 in favor of me in the committee, and this is the end of the time, and if I'm not appointed now, it's going to take till September." And he said, "I'll see what I can do." And the story that came to me was that Dale Bumpers was seen on the floor of the Senate with his arm around Senator Sanford, and then Senator Sanford withdrew the hold. So to me, that was a very interesting Washington thing.
Okay, so when you arrived at the commission, what were some of the key issues that were on the table? Of course, we're a couple months away from the from October, what did it look like things were going to be about? Of course, there's the tender offers and insider trading are the big ones.
Interestingly, the first issue that came to me was the issue of what to do about the Boesky assets. Ivan Boesky had been convicted and charged by the SEC as well, and the result of proceedings for basically buying and selling inside information. As part of their settlement, he had turned over the assets of his investment company in London. And the assets were in the hands of a trustee appointed by the friend of the commission. And the trustee, when I got there, they said, "Well, we have an issue here. The trustee wants to sell the Boesky assets." And I said, "So, what's wrong with that?" They said, "Well, we're concerned that the assets in his investment advisory company, are tainted because the investment advisory company may have had inside information when it transacted its business. So we may be selling to the public assets that are not clean, that are subject to attacks for being based on inside information." So I essentially on my own said, "We're not doing that." My memory may not be right in this, but we caused the trustee to get replaced. So that was the first issue that came up, and I was sort of pleased that within the first couple of weeks that I was there, like, did something.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue that came up had to do with the proposed legislation to define insider trading.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Riegel, I think it was Senator Riegel, wanted it. He was then, had succeeded Proxmire, and he was head of the Banking Committee. He wanted to have some legislation, and the then commissioners had a terrible time agreeing on legislation mm-hmm. that could go forward.
Is that primarily surrounding whether or not the misappropriation theory should be enshrined within?
Well, that's right. There were two interesting issues. One was whether the misappropriation theory should become law or should mm-hmm. be accepted. If you heard about this, that in the Chiarella case, the misappropriation theory had been suggested but not approved, mm-hmm. and it was sort of floating out there. And the other issue had to do with how to deal with analysts. What about analysts who received information in the course of their duties? Should those, this was the Dirks legislation, and Dirks case was then involved then too. And the question was, should they then be subject to insider trading law? So I think the law attempted to to meet both of those problems, and we finally sent it over. But as I remember it went over on a 3-2 vote.
Mm-hmm.
With Fleischman and Grundfest against it, and I had 3 votes for it, and so those two issues were very much, those were the two issues that were basically there. The other thing that, interestingly, in the first days that happened to me was that one of the staff came to me and said, "Well, are you going to Rio?" And I said, "Why should I go to Rio?" And he said, "Well," he said, "the IOSCO meeting is being held down there." This is how naive I was. I said, "Well, tell me about IOSCO." He said, "Well, it's the International Organization of Securities Commissions. All the securities commissioners of the world are going to meet in their annual meeting." And John Shadd used to go. He said, "But now Charles Cox has been going, and he's going." I said, "I'm not going?" And they said, "Well, you can if you want." So then I made arrangements to go down there and for the first time learn about the international securities regulation. And at that time, IOSCO was basically a talking society. All of the commissions belonged to it with no legislative power and no staff. And I was then told that in the summer or fall of 1986, Chairman Shadd had gone to Paris and had given a speech written for him by the SEC staff, in which the SEC staff said, "We should be more than a debating society, a talking society. We should be making policy. And we think that there should be working parties that will make policy in various areas that the commissions, all the commissions can approve of, and then they can go back to their countries and adopt them if they want." So I got down there and got to know all these people and got the sense of the fact that it was not a very dynamic organization, and that the Shadd idea was just barely getting started. It was getting started, and interestingly enough, the SEC staff, we were then by far the most powerful and well-organized securities commission in the world, was heading all the different working groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pleased that I went down there and got to know what was going on, and that encouraged me during my time at the commission to encourage the staff and the commission to be more internationally involved.
On the international thing, I know that there are a couple of kind of entry points. The enforcement cases, I know there were all the memoranda of understanding that were coming through with different countries. But also, to what extent was this, were the banking regulators kind of leading the international conversations? I know that we're not too far away from the first Basel Accord, for example. That's what I'm thinking of.
But in my interactions, the international banking authorities were not important.
Okay,
we did not have a presence in that area. Our quote international area was totally involved in the MOUs.
Okay,
we had a very few number of MOUs. Then and they multiplied greatly while I was there. I mean, in numbers, percentage numbers anyway.
Okay.
But the international was not. International was, to my view, focused on these two areas: MOUs and IOSCO.
Okay.
In fact, the Office of International Affairs was not in existence then. It was a unit within the Enforcement Division.
That's Michael Mann's
Michael Mann
area. Okay. Should we talk about? I feel like should we move faster?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Just before we get to the market price, should we handle these two issues and just kind of see them through the the ones we've just been talking about, insider trading and the legislation?
Well, the insider trading legislation failed.
Right, that failed. But we did get the Insider Trading and Securities Fraud Enforcement Act, which I think which did neither of those things that we talked about, of course.
No. My memory's faulting me, but I Congressman Dingell, who was then chairman of the House Commerce Committee, was a very important figure and very aggressive, and he was always after the commission to do better and more things. And I'll get the incident, but I don't exactly remember the incident, but towards the end of my career, I know it was the Michael Milken investigation and Drexel Burnham investigation. And sort of towards the end of that investigation, when we were successful in getting Drexel Burnham to agree to a settlement, I had a call from Congressman Dingell, and he said, by that time we knew each other pretty well. He said, Chairman Ruder, things get done in Congress when there's publicity in a crisis. He said, do you have any legislation you'd like to have adopted? He said, if you do, send it over. So I went to Gary Lynch, who was the director of Division Enforcement. I said, Gary, is there any legislation you'd like? He said, yes. He said, we have had a draft enforcement bill in the hopper here for a long time. I said, well, polish it up and we'll get it adopted by the commission and send it over to Dingell. And that eventually became the Enforcement Remedies Act, which was passed after I left. That was the way that happened. That he welcomed the legislation.
That's the 1990 Act.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there was the 1988 Act as well, wasn't there? I guess this was when they. When they were allowed to allowed the SEC to have punitive, what would be the term?
Oh, we had we
you
had,
were allowed to take three times the amount back that had been gained in inside trading.
I don't have a good memory of that. I may have been adopted before I came there. I'm not sure about it. I know what you're talking about. 21A, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was not. It was not. You know what happens is that things start while you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And they finish after you're there.
But right.
Things that started before you were there just get done.
They finish while you're there.
They're there, so that's nice. But
right.
That was not a big part of my life then. But the Boesky assets things were, and the IOSCO things, and there was as long as we're on the enforcement area, it didn't happen right away. But I undertook to go to each of the regional offices while I was chairman. I wanted the regional offices to know that the chairman cared. So I went to Boston and I went to New York and I went to California, and I ended up at the Denver regional office. And I had been wanting to go I wanted to walk through and have everybody know I was there. And the Denver regional director said, you're not doing that. He said, you're coming to my office. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And then he had his staff there. He said, I want to talk to you about penny stock fraud. And they then told me about the pump and dump schemes and persuading small investors to buy. He told me cases in which they would some insider would get a big registered now company, public company, and they'd get lots of shares, and then they would create a false market for it, and they would then persuade an investor to make $1,000 purchase, and they'd call them 2 weeks later, said your thousand's worth 2,000, and now wouldn't you like to buy some more? And then they get them way up, and then they just sell out. So they told me about how terrible that was. So I went back to Washington and asked the enforcement staff what was going on. They said, well, it's not only important in Denver, but it's in Salt Lake City and Miami and South Florida. So I formed a I got the staff together, and I said, well, let's get at this in a cohesive way. One of the things that was true of the commission when I was there was that it still is true when I left, basically, was kind of a silo effect. Mm-hmm. You've probably heard about that each division is on its own and they don't talk to each other very much. Worse there then than it was later on. But anyhow, we created something called the Penny Stock Task Force. And we got the disclosure people together and the enforcement people together and the general counsel's people together. And we all talked about what might be a good way to deal with penny stock fraud. And we eventually adopted a rule that is still in existence regarding how to deal with stocks that are valued at $5 or less. Mm-hmm. So that was that part of the enforcement.
And that was an area where there was some balance that needed to be struck between small firms that were attempting to capitalize as well. You mentioned this in your
Small firms were. Yeah. You needed to allow them to go forward without. Mm-hmm. So we ended up with a suitability rule in which we required by our own rule that before an investor could buy in one of these areas in one of these $5 under stocks, he had to agree. He had to disclose his financial condition and agree in writing that this investment was suitable for him. Put another layer of consent into the transaction.
So part of that's rulemaking, and then part of that becomes part of the enforcement remedies in penny stock.
Yes, because you could enforce the rules that way too. And there, as you probably know, even more recently we've had reverse merger situations in which they've been. Even recently, the Chinese firms that come in bought up companies and then merged and sold to the public, and we've got a reemergence of some of this. But
okay, on the question of the tender offers, I know that most of the commission at this time was pretty much in agreement with your position, which was that there wasn't a substantial need to address the situation. But to what extent did that continue to exert pressure from, particularly from Congress?
The tender offer situation was not a very large part of my time. Mm-hmm. It was mostly on the way in, mm-hmm. Except the one incident that occurred later on was when I went to testify before Congress on some tax legislation, and Congressman Ross Dutkowski was to be head of the committee, and the Office of the Chief Economist had just then published a report saying that the only identifiable cause of the 87 market crash that they could find without noise, mm-hmm. which wouldn't allow them to count things, was the proposal to adopt by the Rostenkowski Committee to tax special tax on takeover profits. And I said, you mean you're going to release this report the day before I'm going to publish, before I testify? I said, could you at least wait? So it was, but that's it. But the takeover thing was not very,
It didn't last, right?
And of course, what did last, of course, was the market crash.
Yes. So let's get to that. One of the things that comes up as part of that is the relations between the SEC and the CFTC, of course. And you had spoken about the question of stocks index futures just days before the October crash. So could we maybe start at that level and talk about what the status of the Shad-Johnson Accord was when you arrived, and if it was...
Well, the Shad-Johnson Accord was an accord dealing with jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Over between the CFTC and the SEC. One story that's been was recounted to me often was that, I think was recounted to me by Al Sumner, was that when they were drafting the legislation authorizing the Commodity Futures CFTC, Al went over to the White House to talk about what role the commission would play in futures regulation, mm-hmm. and he and Ray Garrett talked about it, and they were the commodities were they were not in financial futures very much, and Ray said, "Well, we don't want to regulate pork bellies, do we?" So they didn't insist that we regulate them. But eventually, as you know, the legislation said exclusive jurisdiction over financial futures products will be in the CFTC, and the result was that in the Shad-Johnson Accords, I think you're right, that the indices would be subject to stock index indices would be subject to CFTC because they were all futures, cash settled, no delivery of stock, whereas the financial futures, single stock financial futures, would be at the SEC. And so by the time the 87 market crash came, there had begun to be trading in what's called the OEX, the S&P 500, in fairly large volume. Mm-hmm. And I know you must have heard this, but the computer trading was new. But the futures industry was way ahead of the stock industry, and although there were some computers on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, they were devices for the wirehouses to communicate with their branches, and then the actual trades would be done at the specialist post. But the commodities futures people were trading in contracts, which were equivalent to the market, mm-hmm. and the numbers go out of my head, but I think it was there was a correlation between the price of one contract was worth, I think it was 12 points in the Dow. So you could, if there was a 10 point swing in the futures contracts, there was a potentially 120 point swing in the stock market, mm-hmm. and so there began to be an arbitrage between them. So that you could, if the price of all of the index put together as a weighted index was different than the price on the CFTC, then you would arbitrage one way or the other to bring the prices together. So that the effect was that two things. One was you could essentially buy the stock exchange. You could buy all the stocks in the stock exchange in the index with one contract on the commodities exchange, which made it easier for the institutional investors to trade. And mm-hmm. the other thing that was happening was the institutional investor trading was accelerating. There were more mutual funds, more insurance companies, more college endowments, more pension plans that were holding large blocks of securities, and they were trading. They could trade their whole positions in the commodities markets, where it was very difficult to do it in the stock market. Indeed, I know you must have heard about so-called portfolio insurance, mm-hmm. in which the idea was you could use the futures market to hedge your stock positions by buying or selling a futures contract in advance. But the theory was that you didn't have to do that in advance. You could have something called dynamic hedging, in which you would wait until the market started to go down or up, and then you could put your positions in. And so you didn't have to have your capital tied up in these hedging positions. And the result in the stock market crash was that these positions couldn't get. It was like we talked about, you couldn't get out the exit in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Too much demand.
So because of the effects of one market on the other, and globally as well, I guess. I mean, did it seem like the...
you put that up, turn it just for a minute.
Yeah. Did it seem like the division of regulatory responsibilities was just becoming problematic at this point and would have to be renegotiated? After the crash, of course, there you have the Brady Report, which suggests that you know these things need to come together.
It was... I had been briefed.
Mm-hmm.
When you go into the commission, when you've been nominated before you're confirmed, you go to the commission, I spent many, many days there just being told about everything. And the Division of Market Regulation told me about the possible effect of the futures market. And they'd had an event in, I believe it was January of 87, where there was volatility in the market, and they had a report about it. And the staff was really alerting me to that possibility. Indeed, the October 6th talk that I gave in Chicago was basically a staff-written report and worrying about what they called the... I think John Phelan, the head of the... New York Stock Exchange called it the something like the nuclear theory, but we called it the cascade theory.
Mm-hmm.
That is that things would get, they would go down, and then the futures market, because it was allowed quicker trading, would cause the effects to be exaggerated. So, but there wasn't any pre-concern about that, about the issue of the volatility issues between the two exchanges. There was concern about hybrid instruments. Instruments that were derivative instruments, for instance, a bond that was dependent upon the price of oil. So the question is that a future or is that a security? but we that time there was not, before the crash, it was not a big issue, but it certainly was after the crash.
You've told the story of the crash on at least a couple of occasions, and I think you've written about it, and so the documents are available. So I want to ask you to go into your experience of it in great detail. But in the aftermath of it, you know, how long did it take to really kind of appreciate the various factors contributing to what had occurred? Of course, you had some preconception in these issues that we've just been talking about, but... There were a number of other things besides that you started to articulate in speeches over the following year.
If you look at my speeches, I did talk about the crash a lot.
Right.
Immediately after the crash, the Division of Market Regulation began to create a report. And they wrote... excuse me, I'm so sorry. They wrote this... report over a long period of time, and I edited it. I mean, I helped edit it. I didn't read the whole thing that carefully, but I didn't read the appendices. But I helped to write to edit, and the other commissioners did too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took a fairly long period of time for them to get the information. We're not talking about computer generated mm-hmm. audit trails now. We're talking about individual brokerage records and stock exchange records, so that took a couple of months. As I remember, it was January before I testified before Congress and produced this report. I remember my joke was it took 3 months to prepare a three-pound report. Think of what would have happened if we brought it to full term.
Mm-hmm. Was this happening at the same time as Nicholas Brady was putting together his report?
Yes.
Okay. Was there any...
The first report that came out was the Katzenbach report.
Okay.
And And the second one was the Brady Report.
Okay.
And then our report came last.
Okay.
And the I can tell you the most startling thing about the Brady Report was reading the conclusion that the stock futures and the stock market were one market.
Mm-hmm.
And as almost yesterday, I get news, I'm reading it, and they said, and we believe there should be a single regulator, and that regulator should be, and I turn the page, says the Federal Reserve Board. I said, who? What do they know about it? We know about the futures because we regulate the options exchange, and the options exchange really is involved with futures. And so we know how to regulate them and are capable of doing it. And that's when we had arguments at the commission and eventually decided and sent to Congress proposals that jurisdiction be transferred over the financial futures to the SEC.
Okay. And this was
maybe it was just stock market futures. I'd have to look back.
This was a suggestion that you wouldn't have come up with on your own if not for the prodding of the Brady Report?
I don't know.
Okay.
I only know that it did happen that way, that it was
right.
The Brady. Certainly, almost as a defensive mechanism,
mm-hmm.
We wanted to be first and say it's the commission, the SEC, that should regulate this. There's one other important aspect of the follow-up that I don't know if you're kind of into, but I'm going to say January, maybe, I was called to the White House and met with Howard Baker and others, and they said, we believe that there should be some high-level discussion of what should be done about the markets, and we want to form the President's Working Group on the Financial Markets,
mm-hmm.
and we propose that the chairman of that group be the Secretary of the Treasury, and that the members be the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and the chairman of the SEC. And I said, you've read the reports. You must include the chairman of the CFTC as well. Now, if I had been really self-interested, I might have said no, but I didn't at that point have this sense of real conflict between the two agencies. And so that group was organized, and we met for about 3 months before a report was issued in May.
Now, in the sense that there could have been a really substantial high-level alignment, my understanding is that it's simply something that the people in Congress with the separate committees responsible for the CFTC and the SEC would simply not countenance. But, I mean, aside from that, was this a sense that something might go forward to that effect?
No.
No.
In our working group?
No. Sure, or anywhere.
No.
Really. Okay.
Even at the SEC, there was disagreement that Commissioners Fleischman and Grundfest were against it.
Right. And so, I guess that there was quite a bit of that between that, between things like your comments about the market possibly closing on that Monday and so forth, there was quite a bit of heat on you in this period as well.
Oh, heat?
Yeah, I don't even know how to articulate it.
I can only tell you how to articulate it. I can remember receiving a call from somebody saying, the market's down. What are you going to do? I don't know. I mean, we don't know what's going on. And the jurisdictional questions were not quite as apparent. I tell you, one very significant moment that I had was eventually, it turned out that the futures exchanges and the stock exchanges didn't know about each other, weren't communicating. So at one point, I called Kalo Heineman, who was then the chairman of the CFTC, and I said, Kalo, we need to get these people together. So we had a meeting just in my office at the SEC between John Phelan, who was head of the New York Stock Exchange, and Leo Melamed, who was head of the Chicago Merck. And we sat, the four of us, just the four of us. And, of course, you only remember this one-sided, but my memory was, I said, look, this is an issue of cooperation between the two exchanges, and if you don't at least get to know each other and communicate with each other, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And so I was very adamant in trying to insisting on cooperation between the two of them. And I think it got better. One of the things that we learned in the crash was that they didn't even know who to call. They didn't know the name of anybody in the other exchange to call, other than maybe the chairman. There was no staff interaction at all.
The last question that I want to ask about these jurisdictional questions are these court cases, I guess, over the stock index futures, where the Board of Trade and the Merck, I guess, sue the SEC over, I guess, the regulatory jurisdiction. How did that unfold? I mean, how did that come about, and how did it become resolved?
Well, I know how it got resolved. Right. The SEC lost on most of them. But I don't remember being intensely involved in those court cases, and I would have to look back and see when they were litigated and when they were decided. It very, very well may have been slightly after my time, although there was one issue that was, it had to do with some jurisdiction over the regulation of bonds. And I don't think we lost completely in that case, but I'd have to go back to look at records before I could talk about it intelligently.
Okay. And then as far as the reforms that were put into place after October of 1987, I mean, you are an advocate of increasing the margins, and that was something that didn't make its way through. But then there were the circuit breakers. But it's all kind of... it's all a bit of a scrum in the historical record.
Well, when that, I learned more than I care to learn about how government works. When I was called to the White House, this is in January, maybe February, they said, we want you to form this committee, working group, but we want you to agree not to put any legislation forward until the report comes out. And I remember, this is 1988. I'm in office for 4 months, and I'm not a Washington insider. And it wasn't until the summer of 1988 that we finally put our legislation forward. But now it's summer and Congress is going to adjourn, and I suddenly realized that one of the results of my agreement not to go forward with this legislation was that the legislation wouldn't get put forward in a time in which Congress was terribly exacerbated about, terribly worried about this at all. It would be faded away, so that the time for congressional action in times of crisis would sort of disappear. So that was a hard lesson, but I learned it the wrong way. There were six pieces, of legislation that we proposed eventually. The two that we called, there were four we called the four easy pieces, mm-hmm. and the other two were transfer of jurisdiction to the SEC and the margins. Those were not easy, and I don't think I can give you all the detail on all of the other ones. Again, you have to look back, but I know we had emergency powers, mm-hmm. and we had coordination of coordination of two markets in some other ways. But I'd have to go forward to get all of them. But the interesting part about the president's working group, at least from my point of view, was that it rather quickly eroded into an argument by the Fed, the Treasury, and the CFTC that the margins in the stock market and the margins in the futures market were economically equivalent. The two markets work quite differently. In the margins, in the stock markets, you have a rule that says when you buy a security on margin, you have a, I believe it was 35%, but it may have been 50% mm-hmm. Requirement. But that's initial margin. And if you have other securities, you could borrow against those securities to buy the other securities. So in fact, what happened was that the brokerage firms installed their own informal margin requirements. Again, I think it was 25%, may have been 35%, but mm-hmm. in that range. But in the futures market, they had initial margins of up to 5%. And then they had something called variation margin, in which was a daily calculation as to whether you had bought or lost or gained in the market. So if you buy a contract in which you're betting a bet, I bet that the market will go up, and bet that the market will go down, and every day we settle up. So if I owe you something, I pay, and if you owe me, you pay. So that in a sense, it's a protection against you or me not paying. But we took, our position was that the low futures market were speculative futures, and that got everybody very excited. And we spent enormous number of hours worrying about it, with all kinds of studies and whatnot, and. Finally, the Treasury had an economist who was very free market oriented. The Fed and Alan Greenspan were free market oriented, and the CFTC, we believed, was primarily interested in protecting the functions of the exchanges. Their obligations had to do with protecting the ability of the exchanges to function well in the trading environment. Mm-hmm. Our obligations had to do with market efficiency, protection of investors, and capital formation. So we had broader kinds of responsibilities, and it had caused us to look at markets in a different way. So we argued that there was speculation caused by the low markets, by the low margins, and we got a big fight with it. And they kept insisting. It was 3-1 insisting that the margins were the same. He said the margins are equivalent in both markets. So in early May, or maybe late April, before my report was to come out, I was called into the Secretary of Treasury's office and was asked whether I would agree to a unanimous report of our President's Working Group. And I said, I will agree on one condition. I said, we have disagreement about whether the futures markets and the securities markets margins are the same. I said, if the report is silent on that particular point of view, I will sign the report. So we got to the first session with the first draft comes, and the paragraph or paragraphs about the margins is in the report. I was, if you can imagine, very upset by what I regarded as failure to putting me in a tough position. Now I had said I would agree in a unanimous report, and now they present me a report I can't agree to. So we ended up drafting a couple of rebuttal paragraphs, and I didn't dissent from the whole report, but the paragraphs I dissented from that point of view, and that caused an enormous fuss in Congress and all around, and I think actually when we went forward with the two hard pieces of the six pieces, mm-hmm. I knew in my heart they wouldn't get adopted, but I thought it was the right thing to do, mm-hmm. and that's probably where to my mind the way in which the jurisdictional and margin thing got put up caused me a lot of heartburn because I had to testify before the ag committees and they didn't particularly like my points of view.
Were the four easy pieces as easy as they were anticipated to be?
They were adopted. I don't exactly remember. I say they were so easy I can't remember chapter and verse about all of them, but they were adopted, including the later on it turned out that our emergency powers piece that gave the commission the power to close the markets after consulting with the president, mm-hmm. was very important to Harvey Pitt when the World Trade Center thing happened.
Right, right. At the time, reading back over your speeches and some other documents, it seemed as if the repeal of Glass-Steagall was imminent at that time. what's your recollection of that?
One of the interactions I had with the banking community, mm-hmm. was a long-held position by the SEC that if the banks were to be involved in the securities business, they should be treated as broker-dealers and regulated by the SEC. What happened was that the controller of the currency issued exemptions for the banks, gradually allowing them to engage in securities activities. Not all of them, mm-hmm. but we were upset that they were gradually allowing the banks to become securities dealers without being controlled the way securities dealers were. So and the policy reason I think is still in existence, and you're seeing it today in the whole FSOC problems here. You're still seeing it because the feds are basically concerned with the safety and soundness of banks, and the Securities Exchange Commission is concerned with protection of investors. So the bank regulators want to have the banks not to go insolvent, but they don't have the same concern over the bank owners, whereas the SEC has responsibility to protect the investors. So and that also slopped over into the bank activities as broker dealers. Mm-hmm. So Senator Proxmire called me in his office one time, and he said, "I'm going to put a bill forward to repeal Glass-Steagall. Will you support me?" And I said, "Well, yes, but that repeal has to say that if Glass-Steagall is repealed, that the banks will be treated as broker dealers. There's an exemption in the 34 Act exempting banks from being broker dealers." So he thought about it, and he said, "Well, we'll see if we can arrange that." And I can't remember the timing of this exactly, but he thought about it. I don't remember this. He said, because the timing is odd, later on, he agreed at one point to put that provision in the bill. And at a later point, he called me at home later on to say, "I apologize to you, the bill's going forward without that provision in it." And I don't remember whether it was in the first meeting or the second meeting with him, but I said, "Senator Proxmire, we're going to oppose the bill." I think it was in the first meeting. I said, "Senator Proxmire, we're going to oppose the bill if you don't have this in it." And a reason that it's a little emotional for me was when he said he wasn't going to vote for me. He said, "I don't think you're going to be a tough regulator." And when I said, "I'm going to oppose your bill," he looked at me and said, "I'm your chairman. I'm the chairman of your," at least this is what I remember. He said, "I'm the chairman of your committee. You can't do that." And I said, "Oh, yes, I can. Because we believe that we have to have the protection of investors." And in my mind, I was saying, "And you said I wouldn't be a tough regulator? Listen to me now." But that Glass-Steagall Act failed, right. and we were public or not, but I remember being some senator's office in which they were all over us about the fact that we weren't going to support the bill. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if that was before or after he said he put the provision in. I mean, that time frame escapes me.
Okay. And then one other thing that I definitely wanted to ask about is municipal securities. We've been looking at, we're putting together a gallery on those that's practically finished right now. But, of course, you were there when the Rule 15C212 comes through. And, of course, the Whoops report is part of that. And I'm wondering if you can give me your perspective on how all that came about and who came up with 15C212.
The Whoops report came first. The commission had been working on the Whoops report for a long time before I got there. By the time the report came through, three out of the five commissioners had recused themselves, so there were only two of us left, as to whether or not we should go forward and recommend any kind of action at all. The report was huge. It had followed, if you may remember, the New York City problems of some years ago. Mm-hmm. But Charles Cox was the only one that wasn't recruited, so he and I talked along about it. But eventually, it turned out that there were tremendous class actions involved in the Whoops failure, so big that they used to have to rent halls to have meetings of all the lawyers to deal with the class actions. I think they're all consolidated in, I remember it as Texas, but it could have been someplace else. And this is fairly far along in my chairmanship, but I then began to try to figure out what it would cost the commission in terms of time and resources to pursue actions. Quite interestingly, in retrospect, I was quite concerned about the failure of the rating agencies to downgrade the whoops when they should have known that there were these problems there. And it was the I think the phrase is take or pay. Take or pay provision in it. If you didn't, their contract said if you don't take the electricity, you have to pay for it anyway. Something like that. It caused tremendous problems with them. But I was concerned that there was the aftermarket wasn't being taken care of properly. That you may have had disclosures at the time of the original sale of the municipal bonds, but nothing was being done afterwards. By either the underwriters weren't doing anything, the credit rating agencies weren't doing anything, and the issuers weren't doing anything. So we eventually recommended not to take action, and got some heat from it for Congress. But subsequently, the Division of Market Regulation came up with Rule 15C2-12, which was, to my mind, brilliant. You may know about the Tower Amendment, which says you can't, the SEC can't require disclosure. But we came up with the idea that since these were underwriters who were selling these bonds, the underwriters had to have a reasonable basis for the selling of the bonds. And therefore, if they hadn't had the offering circular in front of them at the time they sold the bonds, they couldn't have the reasonable basis. And that, to me, was a really brilliant way of forcing the issuers to make an offering circular, forcing the underwriters to read it, and then represent that this was a suitable recommendation. So I just thought that was a brilliant way around the Tower Amendment. And as you know, Rule 15C2-12 has been amended two or three times, and the EMMA depository has been there at the MSRB.
Much more recently, of course.
Yes, but
it's been an interesting set of interviews, getting through the whole array of things that had to happen before one ultimately got to EMMA. We obviously don't have to go into that now.
No, because we're talking about history here.
Yes.
The brilliant idea of using the underwriter as the fulcrum of the regulation has allowed the regulation of the municipal securities area to go forward in a very strong way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there wasn't much you could do besides, except under the fraud provisions.
So. Right, yeah.
No, it is really the fulcrum of that whole history, so it's interesting to get the SEC perspective on that.
Well, and it's wonderful that the commission is concerned about municipal securities now.
Yes. We've been going on at some length, and so I'm conscious I don't want to
it's all right.
Kill your throat from talking.
Better off since I've gotten a little something to drink here.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to get into from your time as chairman? I have miscellaneous issues, but like I say, I don't want to go on without end.
Well, I think from a historical point of view, one of the historical points that goes forward was my understanding that before the Sunshine Act, the Commission behaved in a very collegial way, and you could adopt rules without having everything be in public. I just turn this off for a minute.
Sure.
The commission was more collegial, and it was for a long period of time a commission in which, if there were disagreements, they weren't made public. When I became chairman, maybe it was my style, or maybe it was the style of the people, other commissioners, but there began to be public statements of disagreement. Not dissents in the way they are now, but public statements of disagreement. And so it was disturbing to me that we couldn't behave in that collegial way. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was only the beginning of the current commission, in which there are policy splits at the commission. And I eventually ended up deciding that if I could pass things by a 3-2 vote, that was commission action. Mm-hmm. And at one point I said to Chairman Donaldson, when he got in the same position, I said, "Bill," I said, "three votes are enough." So that really is it's part of the history of it.
No, I was surprised when I was talking to Ed Fleischman. You know, I mentioned the Sunshine Act, and he said, "No, I have no problem with the Sun." I got the impression that he kind of liked to have things out in public a little bit. That was his preference.
I like Ed. He's a mm-hmm. wonderful, fine man.
He said very nice things about you, too.
I really do. I'm really fine. But he had one trait that used to annoy me, and it's part of that same attitude. He would bring his the way rules would get adopted at the commission was because of the Sunshine Act. Your legal counsel, since you couldn't talk to all the commissioners together, your legal counsel could meet. So they would hash things out together and then come back to us and say, "Here's the problem." So we would deal with the problems, and occasionally we'd have one-on-one talks, but eventually we would come to some conclusion. But Ed had this habit of not revealing his positions until the public meetings. Ed! But that was all right. He was always very persuasive, and he was to the... You don't really know what you're going to be like until you get there. And I turned out to be much more regulatory than I thought I would be. Mm-hmm. And I think more than the Reagan people thought I was going to be.
Well, that's kind of the thing that I guess I wanted to get to, is I know that the executive branch, and I don't know if it started under Reagan or if it was the Bush administration, that they made things very difficult for you. I don't really know the details of that, but this is what I've heard.
Difficult.
Ultimately, that in a sense you were compelled to, you know, resign in 1989. I don't know if they asked you to, in general they made it known.
That was fascinating. After Bush the First was elected, and he had his transition team, and I an article appeared in the Bond Buyer that said Reuter's not going to be reappointed. So then I was concerned about not knowing what I was doing, so I went over to the White House to talk to the head of the president's financial transition team, and he said, "We are going to replace all of the heads of all of the administrative agencies." He didn't do it personally to me. Mm-hmm. He said, "Except for Wendy Graham." Of course, Wendy Graham was the wife of Senator Phil Graham, and that was politically not a very wise choice. So I'd been there now for a year and a half, and it had been very much more strenuous than I thought. And I thought in my own mind, I think if I really fought for this, I might be able to stay. Mm-hmm. But I said, what would I be buying into if I stayed here? I would be having. Now I'd have to commit to 4 more years of this kind of tension and stress that I've been having, a situation in which...
Sorry, when was your term supposed to end?
Well, it ends at... the president can appoint... The president can choose a chairman from among the 5 commissioners. Mm-hmm. The chairman doesn't get to appoint the chairman. He appoints the chairman as the commissioner, but it's usual that the chairman is assured when he's appointed as a commissioner that he will be chairman. But theoretically, the president could say, "Reuter's no good, I'm going to appoint Fleischer," even though they're both chairman. But then that doesn't happen. But so my term was going to be ending when the new president came in.
Okay.
And so I said, orally, I said, fine. I said, when you have my replacement, let me know, and I'll resign. But I did not send in my letter of resignation. I did not say, I hereby resign. Mm-hmm. I did nothing. And interestingly enough, that they didn't get around to reporting to me until October the following year. So I ended up with a full two-year session. Mm-hmm. And I never knew whether that was because I was so good they couldn't find anybody to replace me, or I was so bad that they just decided to leave me in office. But
just in general, their decision to replace heads of agency, I mean, was that just because they wanted their own people in there?
I suppose.
Because, I mean, of course, eventually you were replaced by Chairman Breeden, and he was one of their people.
Interestingly enough, I did not have any interference or suggestions from the White House the whole time I was chairman. Mm-hmm. Nobody called and said, you're not doing things right, or you should do this, or you should do that. It was not political. Mm-hmm. And it may have been in part because this was the end of the Reagan time and they didn't really have a strong agenda at that point. Mm-hmm. So I felt quite independent, and I thought I was doing a good job. That's for history to decide, but we did do a lot of things, and the market was the market got better eventually. I told my wife that I thought the nomination process would be finished by February or March. Mm-hmm. I said we can go home surely by April. In April, I said, I don't know when. And finally, I did then finally send a letter in mid-April, something like that, to the president saying, I agree to resign as commissioner at such time as my successor as chairman has been confirmed and is or will be in office. So I didn't leave until I think a week before Chairman Breeden came in.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that I didn't was that I found that it was very difficult for the commission to function without a real chairman, mm-hmm. with just an acting chairman, and I think particularly when you have a chairman who's likely to be more independent of the political process than the others, than is true of the commissioners now. But then I did not want the commission to be in the kind of disarray that it was in when I came.
So then after that, you've served in a number of capacities on a number of different boards, beginning, I think, with the NASD.
Yes. The day I was appointed to become my appointment came public, the head of public affairs at the White House said to me, your life will never be the same. Mm-hmm. Yes, I became a member of the NASD board because Joe Hardiman came to me. And he was the head of the NASD at that time. And I believed that the automation in the NASDAQ market was much more likely to produce a successful market than the way that New York was trading, although I learned a lot at the NASD. And then Arthur Levitt, who had been a couple of years behind me at Williams College, and we became pretty good friends. And he asked me if I would help to start the Historical Society, which I did. I was the first chairman of the. I organized a group of people to start the society, and then we started it. And then Harvey Pitt and I and Paul Gonson were really instrumental in getting it really going. And then we hired Carlo Rosati, which was a great decision. Since then, it's got its own life. But we were quite concerned for a while that there wouldn't be the financial support for the institution that there has been.
But Arthur Levitt recruited you for a couple of other.
Then he recruited me to be. He then recruited me to be an independent member of the Financial Accounting Foundation. that that is the foundation that oversees the FASB.
Right, he had just been in kind of single-hand combat with them.
He had been in combat with them, and there was a lot, when I found it, there was a lot of unhappiness about him because he had been very forceful. Mm-hmm. And then when I was at the FAF, I became chairman of the International Committee and began to be worried and concerned about the effort of the International Accounting Standards Committee to create international accounting standards, and I was worried about the fact that there was this collision coming between GAAP and mm-hmm. and international accounting standards, and so I was in negotiation with them for a couple of years, and served then on the what they call the strategy working party of the ISC, and we were in existence for 2 years, and finally came up with a report that created a structure for the international IASB, which was then adopted by the IFAC, which is the accounting equivalent of an association, which then but before that had controlled the IASC, and then. Chairman Leavitt, Arthur Leavitt, was then responsible for getting me appointed as one of the new trustees of the IASCF Foundation, now called the IFRS Foundation. So I had these three things that mm-hmm. That Arthur did, and then actually under Arthur's at the time Arthur was there, I had a call one day from the SEC staff and said, would I be willing to organize an educational organization for independent directors, which I did, and that's now called the Mutual Fund Directors Forum, mm-hmm. which I was chairman for 10 years before that. I'm still an emeritus board member. So that was a lot of public service.
So I know, exactly.
And I've continued here at Northwestern to administer the San Diego Securities Regulation Institute and the Ray Garrett Jr. Corporate Securities Regulation Institute. The San Diego's Institute was the house party one that I talked about. Mm-hmm. And when after I left the commission, Bob Mundheim called me and asked me if I would be chairman of that institute. And I agreed to do so. And then at the year that I became chairman, the University of California said they didn't want to administer anymore. So I said, okay, we'll do it.
So you've seen a number of some of the more controversial issues up close in your time in these various organizations. For example, the SEC's effort to put in independent directors of mutual funds. You were involved with that from the Mutual Fund Directors Forum. Can you tell me about that, or about, I guess, some of the accounting issues springs to mind? You were working on the accounting of derivatives, right, with the FAF?
And that well, still... yes, at the FAF we had a couple of issues that had to do with the independence, and Congress wanted to have all of our GAAP rules be approved by Congress. Some of the business people were formatting that, so we spent quite a bit of time fighting that off. At the IASB, we adopted some regulations dealing with the board adopts them, but we oversee mm-hmm. them. We were adopting a regulation having to do with accounting for derivatives, and the European Union adopted them all, but with a carve out for futures, mm-hmm. which changed the whole environment. So, I've been involved substantively with that. I'm personally very concerned about the effort to try to create to try to have IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, used by U.S. issuers. And I'm not happy about having the IASB, whose governing body may eventually be controlled by the European Union or other foreign countries, deciding what our GAAP standards should be. Mm-hmm. My view is that the original focus was on having comparable standards, not exactly the same.
It seems like in a lot of cases, one sees the same issues come up again and again. Is it a case that the issues evolve, like you have these annual meetings and you make a little bit of progress at a time, or are there long periods of frustration before activity, you know, finally manages to get through this agreement?
Things basically don't move very fast unless there's a crisis. On the mutual fund area, there have been independent directors for a long time, and the question has been how to change the environment so that the directors feel empowered to protect the shareholders as opposed to cooperating with the advisors. So the Mutual Fund Directors Forum that we've created is independent of the advisors and has, I think, been very important in helping a gradual increase of responsibility by independent directors. The most interesting comparison one can make right now has to be with what happened in the 87 market crash and what's happening with high-frequency trading. You may, if you look at my piles of books here, see that I have Flash Boys, High Frequency Trading, High Frequency Game Changing, a whole bunch of books which are related to the crash. And I've been fascinated with the developments in that area now as compared to what we were looking at in 1987. And until recently, I was very concerned that the Commission wasn't doing anything about potential market breakdowns, but their new regulation SCI is moving in that direction.
For all the thematic similarities, I mean, is it a completely different set of issues with all the different technologies that one has now? Or is it a case of going back to the history of, say, the 87 market crash?
No. It's all changed. The markets have changed a long time. Mary Shapiro had me appointed to the joint CFTC committee on market regulation, which we put out a report dealing with the flash crash. And basically, things have changed so much, particularly in the last 6 or 8 years, that the technical issues are different, but the fairness to investors and institutional investors, the protection against volatility, the problems of market efficiency, and the possible problems of possible market breakdowns are all still with us. It's just that the mechanics are different.
Analogous problems, but with specific solutions.
Specifics are different.
Different specifics.
The other important matter is the other important matter is the question of big data. How's that operating? As you may know, the Commission is now faced with huge information dumps in the trading environment, and the question now of how to deal with the Edgar information in a rational way. We just finished I just finished being chairman of a group to talk about the future of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in a changing world, the conference was established. Basically, it was the idea for the conference originated with Rod Hills, and he enlisted Harry Pitt and me to help him create the conference, and then he died, unfortunately. And so Harvey and I undertook to have the conference anyway to talk about the role of the commission in a changing world, which is a very, very difficult question.
You were also involved with the PCAOB.
Yes, I was. When Bill McDonough was the first chairman of PCAOB, he started the a PCAOB advisory committee of a high-level group of people. I'd known Bill when he was here at the bank in Chicago, and then he became chairman of the New York Fed. But when he became chairman of the PCAOB, he put me on the first advisory committee for the PCAOB, and I've been attending those meetings since the PCAOB started. I'm now an emeritus member, but I still attend when I can. So,
was that an organization? I guess you joined in 2004, which is a couple of years into it. But
no, it was the first year.
Oh, it was the first year.
It was the first year they started the committee.
Oh, I see.
But there's another. There's a technical advisory mm-hmm. committee that worries about what the rules say. We try to give advice about the broad scope of where they're going.
Was that a difficult organization to get going in the wake of
PCAOB?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, very hard, and it took quite a bit of time mm-hmm. before it got its sea legs. But it's I think it's functioning very well now.
And what were some of the key issues in those early times that you?
Well, the first question was how to deal with the funding, which Congress solved, mm-hmm. and the next question was how big should the staff be and what should they be paid, and then. How should they go about adopting generally accepted accounting principles and all kinds of questions there? And then what role would they have with it's gotten into the question, what role would the PCAOB have to do with audit committees and the way they function? And how much could the PCAOB indirectly deal with how the companies create their finances? That's a very difficult area. Mm-hmm. But as you know, the PCAOB is very closely monitored by the SEC because mm-hmm. they have statutory power. The FASB is not so greatly controlled, except that the Commission has delegated to the FASB the right to create GAAP, so it could always withdraw mm-hmm. that, but you never know where that's going to be. It's unlikely they'd ever do that. So, my life has changed.
Yes,
and I've been very happy with my association with the SEC and people in it. I'm a great admirer of all of the people I've known and the SEC people.
Well, I don't have any more questions myself, and it seems like a good place to stop.
I have a promise to leave here shortly. So,
all right. Well, very good then. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Appreciate it.